Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 30 of Zion's Finest. This is Kenny Brown, and I am joined by two of my brothers, Scott and Sam. What we're going to be doing today is we're going to be talking, it's going to be a little bit of a meta review, figure review, as well as talking about tournaments, structuring tournaments, organizing tournaments. It's kind of a sequel to the episode that we released on Christmas about community building, but it's going to be a lot more focused on the nuts and bolts of running, of organizing and running a tournament. Before we get into that, we just want to encourage everyone to rate and review the podcast and submit games on the Zion's Finest Google form. That actually reminds me that I've got, if Scott has not submitted our recent games, that I've got to do that.
Oh yeah, we should do that.
Well, we'll do it.
I'll do that while we're talking.
We have, for our shout-outs, the one that I want to really shout out is Imperial Terrain, and here's why. So in 2 weeks, we are going to LVO. It's going to be super fun. Scott, are you going to be playing MCP at LVO?
No, me and Matt are taking a painting class.
Oh, okay. Well, that's also very awesome. So we're all going to LVO. We're going to be playing in the after hours event, playing a bunch of board games, doing painting, doing everything. The thing that we were asked to do, that Zion's Finest was asked to do, was coordinate producing enough terrain so that we could have this after hours event. So they originally, I think they only had 10 or 12 seats open, and I reached out to them about expanding it, and they were very generous and said they could, but the issue was that they were going to need terrain. So we have been pounding the pavement and drumming up terrain from members of the community. Also, I can't remember who it was, but someone on the Slack asked me to reach out to Imperial Terrain, John from Imperial Terrain, because he has designed some really cool Shatterpoint stuff. I think he's pretty well known in the Legion scene. He's done some really cool custom terrain. So I reached out to him and said, hey, just FYI, we're doing this thing. It'd be really awesome if we would love to have you be able to lend some terrain pieces for LVO. And he was such a good sport about it. He shipped them out. I got them this last week. He shipped out 2 terrain sets. He was going to do more, but based on the number of, shipping is a ton of money, and based on the number we were able to get locally, we only needed 2 from him. And they are so cool in terms of the texture of the pieces and just how everything looks. He's got these 2 terrain sets that are just awesome. So we're going to be bringing those to LVO along with all the other ones. But I would really encourage you, if you're looking for custom terrain, Imperial Terrain is awesome. And John is such a good guy, and I want to thank him for doing that. Also, I think he sponsors the Hello There podcast. So what you should do is you should listen to Hello There, because I think they've got some kind of a promo code for purchasing terrain from Imperial Terrain. So anyway, do all those things. Hello There released an awesome episode recently. It was they're actually going to Adepticon, it sounds like. They're going to Adepticon. And they were talking kind of about a survey of 2024, what they're hoping to happen to the game in 2024, what they're hoping to accomplish in 2024. It's awesome. And then Momentous Struggle just released an episode that was kind of similar to what we did. Looking back, looking forward, that's what everyone's doing. It's the start of the year. So check out both of those episodes. You will have a ton of fun. That's it. That's it for the introduction. Let's talk about recent games. Scott, do you want to go first?
Yeah. So I'll talk about our 2 games that we did. So we were kind of both trying out something new, because I'm trying to figure out what I want to run in LVO in terms of like the premier list. So Kenny and I played 2 games. He ran basically the same thing both games. It was Anakin Dooku with Jango, Kraken, B1s, Magnus.
Yep.
In our first game, I played basically Mace, Padme, obviously both of those kind of have, all you need to know is it's Mace, Padme, and you know the whole list.
Yep.
And then in the second game, I played Vader with Obi-2 and Arfs, and Luminara with Jango and Super Commandos. So in our first game, both the games actually kind of went along the same line, which was a really, really, really competitive struggle 1. Both of these are in Sabotage Showdown, where we were just trading points back and forth. I kind of got the break point towards me, so Kenny was getting a few extra momentum points from, I'm 4 up and we're trading 3 points back and forth, so he's getting more momentum. But eventually, the attrition just went towards me, and I was able to pull out struggle 1. Incredibly quick struggle 2s, where I think, Kenny, you won in 2 or 3 turns.
Yeah, it was super fast.
Yeah, super, I mean, in the first game, I just kind of said, I'm not even going to compete. I'm just going to try and set up for the next struggle, which I had middling success in that. I obviously it was better than if I hadn't, but I think one of the virtues, what I like about Sabotage Showdown is Struggle 3 is not so... It is not a guarantee that the first person that won Struggle 1 is going to win Struggle 3 in Sabotage Showdown.
Absolutely.
Which, absolutely, it's never, yeah, a guarantee, but I think Sabotage Showdown does a lot to mitigate what, you know, I think is a problem there. So we go into Struggle 3 and have a super close Struggle 3 again, and in both games, there's sort of a very specific break point that we experience. So in the first game, you know, Anakin performed really well in both games. In the first game, particularly, where he's coming in, he's wounding secondaries. I don't think he ever went for a primary, really. He just went for the secondaries.
Yep.
Except for when he hit Padme, the domestic abuser.
Yes, I did. That's right.
And, you know, getting those extra... One of the things was that Kenny would be down points-wise, just in terms of objectives, but he didn't necessarily need to go for that extra point, because if Anakin is wounding, it's buying you time. And that, yep, that extra struggle is you're able to move it a little bit further just so you're not falling as far behind. But Mace was able to one-shot B1s and take, basically, get a point over for me across the map, because the B1s, yeah, were split so far apart. And then he also was able to one-shot Jango in a shatter point, which, fun fact, I never really got to use Mace's shatter point ability because he was never on the right side at the right time.
Yeah.
It's actually funny. I pulled Mace, like, I think first. It was first or second activation, and I was like, I should probably reserve him, right? And he's like, yeah. The only thing that would be worse if you got the shatter point card. And I was like, well, true, but I have, it's a 1 in 6 chance. And then that's exactly, yeah, what I pull. So,
yeah.
But yeah, so super close game. What were the point that I can say that came down to was basically Kenny had 3 cards left in his deck, and it was Anakin is ideal. Jango would be able to do something. Kraken would basically be able to do nothing. And he already had Magnus in reserve. So he pulls Kraken, basically has a completely wasted activation, and I just am able to steamroll off of that.
Yeah.
Second game, I mean, Luminara, you know, is a really interesting figure with Vader, because everyone is doing a lot of damage, and then she's healing them. She's giving you extra movement when you wound. It was an interesting play, again, kind of really close back and forth. I'm able to play it out mostly from just having, like, Jango and the Mandalorians control sort of the middle points. We have a very lopsided game on, like, the right side of the map, where we're not doing a lot on the other side of the map. Dooku comes really far forward and takes one of my back points, because I had been, like, up, like, 4-2, and then it evened out because you took one of my back points. And wounding, I put shots into Dooku because I had nothing else to do, and it at least was costing him a force, because I exhausted. I think, Kenny, you spent 5 force.
I spent all my force to keep him alive. You attacked with Vader. I spent literally all of my force to keep him alive.
But yeah, you spent a lot of force. So and Vader didn't really pay for it. I think you hit Vader back and didn't. I don't even think you could hit Vader back. You didn't have enough force.
I didn't. Because I didn't have force. I'd spent it all.
Right. So basically, then I moved Obi-Wan up, hit you, did some damage, and then just took the point back from numbers. But it was an interesting point, because it just goes to show how tanky Dooku is. He just is so hard to put damage into. And honestly, I wouldn't have done it if I had literally any other choice.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's just kind of how that goes. Then we have sort of the breakneck on my point is basically if I wound a Magna Guard with Jango, I'm able to score the momentum point. I will then be able to use Luminara's ability to dash another character, which will let me take a different point.
Yep.
And nobody's really over there, so I kind of will be able to have this point for a long time, because neither of us had it. It was just something that we didn't have activations over that area. And the Magna Guard had 5 damage on him. He might have even been exposed, but I did a 7 die attack from Jango, was only able to do 3 damage, and at that point, I just sort of ran out of steam, and Kenny was able to come in, and I think you won because I think you might have won on, I mean, it was a big point swing that you did.
Yeah, what happened was Anakin came up and he attacked Lumi. You mind tricked him because I focused and attacked. So you mind trick the attack because you have to, or she's going to die. So I spend two force and do, I'm going to end this. And Anakin one shots Lumi. And having killed Lumi, it takes the point. I get the extra momentum from Anakin. I get the wounding momentum. And then at that point, I was also able to swing the other point.
Yeah.
The Magnus had been able to swing it. So I scored 6 points in one activation.
Exactly. So it was a huge swing there. And, you know, to highlight there, as is obviously clear, Anakin is really quite useful at overcoming mind trick because his attacks are so deadly. This was sort of, I was reminded of something from Imperial Assault where we had Jedi Luke, who also gets two attacks. They're free, so it's not like you're paying resources like you are with Anakin here, but neither of Luke's attacks were very good.
Yeah.
So you kind of had to do both of them in order to do sort of one total attack that would, because the idea is like he can go and hit two small things and do something, but if you're going up against something big, he's not really doing a ton. Versus Anakin, you know, he's doing the one attack and then getting a second attack, but both of them have the potential to one-shot because he is the single highest damage dealer in the game.
Yeah, Anakin, so it's super interesting because I played Anakin a few times when the game came out with Republic, and he was bad because it's not that he is bad, it's that he just doesn't really work in the Republic because it's not that you need to have the 2-4 saved every single time, but you kind of do if you're going to get what Anakin needs to do. You need to be able to project that kind of threat. And so what I did most of the time was I kept Anakin on Form 5 Sheehan because he's still doing a ton of damage, even if his expertise is not as good as Jemso. And my idea was I'm going to use him as a finisher, like wound, like killing figures that are already wounded or have already taken some damage. And if necessary, I'm going to dive him in. But Dooku, Jango, and Magnus are kind of able to carry a lot of the weight. And then Anakin is more of a flanker, diving in, getting you the wound that you need. I mean, if looking at his tree, so if you're listening, you can't see this. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see that Anakin, just his damage spikes so quickly. 7 damage on 3 steps on Jemso is wild. Like, that is just wild.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I remember there was a time...
And so most...
With Lumi, you were like, oh, I have to do 5 damage. And it's like, okay so you have to get 2 steps?
2 steps, yeah, exactly. And so most of the time I'm on Form 5 Sheehan, but if you need to, you can open it up and turn on the gas, and Anakin can kill anybody. And so I never used Anakin to attack Mace because I felt like that was probably the one place. I think it's kind of like attacking Dooku with Anakin, where they have enough defensive tech that that's probably not the best use of him, right? But you want him to be, it's more of a tax of opportunity. I'm not using him as the carry. He's not the carry. Dooku's the carry, right? Jango's the carry. But what Anakin is doing is he's able to get just these incredible swings, and he can project a lot of threat on the board. I didn't have any extra movement for Anakin. I didn't have snips or Rex or anything like that. And I kind of felt that a little bit in the initial struggles. But in Struggles 2 and 3, Anakin is just an absolute monster. If he is in anywhere close to the middle of the board, he's able to... He can take points, he is wounding things, he's just a... And he's very defensive. If he's on Form 5 Sheehan, he's not bad on Form 5 Jemso, just because he's so durable. But he's just a really strong piece, and I was super impressed with him in that list. So, Sam, you've played Anakin Dooku, haven't you?
I've played a lot of Anakin Dooku, one of my all-time favorite lists to run, and Anakin's very solid in that particular list because he usually has the force to do what he wants. You don't have to give him any support.
Yep.
And it's a pretty defensively takey list. As you said, that the defensive expertise on Form 5 is actually quite good.
Yes.
You're negating crits. You have good expertise to block ratios.
Yep.
And 11 health is a lot to chew through. Mm-hmm. And so Anakin can be kind of hard to bring down and just exerts so much pressure while giving that list just a little bit more verticality, which is nice to have in addition to Django.
Yeah, it is. It's also just very nice to be able to have a figure besides Django. So Anakin's not swinging 2 points on a turn like Django can do, but what Anakin can do is functionally get you that same thing. If there's a secondary or primary on a point, he's going to be able to go wound that figure, take the point, get you the extra momentum. Just feels it was really fun. I played it, you know, Scott, we've only played it twice. I haven't played it as much as you, but I just thought, again, it's one of those things that we sound kind of like broken records where everything goes better with Dooku, but Anakin really, there's a lot of ways that Dooku's strengths overlap with what Anakin needs in terms of that force economy. So
yeah,
I thought it was super fun. Scott, which of your list did you like running better? Mace, Padme, or Vader, Lumi?
Well, the irony is that I actually think the better list and the one I liked better is the one that lost, which is Vader, Lumi.
Vader, Lumi.
I think that Vader, Lumi...
It is a cool list.
Vader, Lumi just has a lot of potential that I think... I felt like Mace Padme does... I mean, it does the thing that it is meant to do. It can be a powerful thing. But it felt like I kind of hit the highest extent of what I was going to get out of it.
Yeah.
That this was kind of like the max that it can do. Where I felt with Vader Luminara, I felt like, oh, I'm not used to this. I probably could run this a lot better. Like, this has a higher ceiling that I could get to.
Yes.
And also, I think I didn't make a good choice of supports that I was running. I wouldn't take ARFs. I'd like to figure out something other than Super Commandos to bring. I get why you do, but I'm going to play around with some other stuff. So,
yeah,
I love Padme. I don't love Mace as much. I know you're really big on Mace. I think that
I'm with you, Scott. I think Mace is good, but he has limitations.
Yeah, I never like a figure that has a really complicated ability to make work. So if I think about like the best figures, it's like Dooku. When does his trigger?
Yeah.
You know, when you're wounded. Yep. Okay, that's a super common event. That happens all the time. It's not hard to keep track of. Vader, when you attack. Mace, it's like, okay, well, depending on the form, if you pull the shatter point and he happens to be the right thing that you should shatter point at the time, well, you should run him and you should be able to play him. It's like, okay, so I have to have all of these different conditions that I meet in order to optimally use Mace, and that never feels amazing.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, I love Mace. I think he's an incredible figure, but I think he is extremely linear, right? He presents that problem to your opponent. He's not super flexible because he's the one who's doing everything. And the question is, can your opponent respond to Mace? Most of the time, I think the answer to Mace is kind of the answer to Dooku, is that you don't attack him. You try and be as careful as you can about giving him targets because he's going to kill everything. But the difference is that Dooku is running with this very strong secondary package and also is very reactive in terms of like what Scott said, when your figures get wounded, right? Whereas Mace is just, I'm giving everyone protection steadfast if I'm within 5 and if I'm engaged. You want to shatter point me? Let's go, right? Is the idea. So
another thing, I think reactive abilities are very powerful in this game.
Yes.
The Lumis, yes. The Dookus, the Mama T's, and one of the weaknesses of the Mace Padme list is that you just don't have those.
Yep. Nothing reactive. I totally agree there. Okay, well, Sam doesn't have any recent games because he's a law school student and he's a sucker. But we'll be
just started back up with the second semester orientation, essentially. So
that's a bummer. But
yeah.
We'll be getting games in the future.
Hey, so at least you have summer to look forward to. It's not like you have to get a pseudo job in the summer instead of enjoying it like a normal college student.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
He's a graduate student. Graduate students don't enjoy summers. You guys work. That's your job.
Yep, so, just going to be working.
All right, so what we're going to do now is, before we get to the main topic, I want to do just a quick highlight. We've had a bunch of spoilers come out And I'd like to do some very quick highlights of the figures that have been released. So again, if you're watching this on YouTube, you're looking at my screen. What I want to first talk about is from the Luke box. We can talk about Luke or R2-D2 generally if we'd like. But what I'd really like to do is talk about Boosh first. And then we can talk about R2-D2.
Mostly, I just like the name R2-D2.
It's so great. Oh my gosh, it's such a great name. So, Boosh, so Leia Organa, she has, I am really excited. I think Leia in Boosh and in Ranger form is going to be, they're really strong figures. Her Ranger form, though, she is 7 costs, which is actually, I've got many mixed feelings about that, but I think that Boosh is really strong. She has her start of activation ability is called Fan Out at the start of this unit's activation. One character in this unit or another allied spy character may reposition. The ability to get repositions on you or other characters at the start of activation is incredibly strong. And then she's got this really interesting kit of a active ability called Low Blow that costs 2 force. She has a passive called Fearless and Inventive. And then she has a innate called I Want 50,000 No Less. And all of these abilities are kind of working together. What she's doing is Boosh seems like a figure who's diving into a kind of a scrum. She gets additional dice when she's able to do that. She's able to move people for free with Low Blow. And what she's doing is, the idea here is she's diving into a scrum. She's rolling a lot of dice. She can spike damage. You can see she's only rolling 6 dice, but I think the idea is that with Fearless and Inventive, what it says is when a character in this unit makes a melee attack as part of a combat action, before dice are rolled, this character can use this ability. Add 2 dice to the attack roll for each enemy character other than the target that is not wounded and is engaged with one or more characters. So I think traditionally you're hoping to get just 2 additional dice from that. Obviously you can high roll, but I think you should plan to get 2 additional dice out of that. Get 2 units that you can fight. And man, she's got a pin push on her first 2 steps. She's topping out at, what is that, 9 damage, right? She seems like a really strong figure. What do you guys think about her?
So I think that Leia Boosh is going to be the single best figure that comes out in the wave.
Okay.
I think
interesting.
I think that in terms of like utility that will be provided, and just overall strength that you're going to see in the list, I think she's a super solid figure. She's got really cool abilities. She's got a solid tree, solid dice, solid range, solid expertise, solid all the way around. The only concern that, you know, I think has is just that, you know, there's going to be some really interesting stuff elsewhere. But I always have I'll put it this way. I can see Vader 2 and Luke being really good, but I also can say, okay, but I think other primaries will be just as good, if not better. Like, I don't think Vader 2 beats Vader 1. I think he'll have his spot, and it'll be interesting to see, and obviously we'll have to test and find out. But I look at Leia Boosh, and I go, she occupies a new space where she's going to allow a different keyword. She's kind of doing different things. She's the only one who's doing she's talking about the Anakin thing. Here's an extra momentum, unless your opponent wants to pay force.
Yes.
And so I think in terms of impact, who we're going to see as a major player in the game, it's going to be Leia Boosh.
Yeah. Before Sam jumps in, I just want to say, I think my only concern with Leia Boosh is if, as you're looking at her card, her ranged expertise is fine. Her melee expertise is garbo, and her defensive expertise is not great. And so that's the only thing I'm a little bit worried about is that she might, you know, you're going to need to rely on having a lot of dice in order to overcome that, which she has access to, and also that she might be a little bit frail. She does have 9 health, but anyway, that's just what I was thinking about. Sam, what do you think?
So I think she is going to be a very flexible figure. I think there's going to be 2 different Rebel lists that come out. The Ewok list and General Rebels. She's going to go in the General Rebel list. She's not going anywhere near the Ewok list. I think she's also going to fit into Cad Bane lists.
Yes, I've seen this, and I think that's a great point.
And I think she's the shot in the arm that those lists need. to just like have this. You now have two powerful bounty hunter secondaries because Aura just fell flat. So you have Django, you have Boosh, and I think those lists can do some interesting things with that. I'm not quite as sold to Scott that she's going to be the very best in this wave, but I could see her. I could see that happening. I think part of it is that she's going to actually struggle to get that innate off. I think for her to wound people is going to be tricky. They got to be softened up.
Yep.
Just because if she's good expertise, only six dice. That's not going to get five steps a lot, which she really needs to get that three damage at the end. She's in melee, not going to get the five steps a lot because her expertise is bad. Yeah. So it's going to be, she's going to want to attack softened up targets, but I still think she can do some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah. I want to draw attention to this low blow ability because, so it costs two force, which is a little scary, but what it says is choose a character in this unit and an enemy character it is engaged with. Push the chosen enemy character two away from the chosen ally character. Then push the chosen ally character two towards the chosen enemy character. After all moves are resolved, this unit may make a focus action. So the idea is that you've got guaranteed displacement, which is amazing. It's this two push, which feels really strong, and you get a focus, right? So I think that if she's one of those figures where her expertise not being great is probably the only thing keeping me from joining Scott and saying, oh yeah, she's the best. But I can just see she's just going to reward skilled play and she can high roll like a monster. So it'll be really, really cool to see her.
Here's the thing. I can definitely see you being right, Scott. Like she definitely could be. I just haven't critically thought about it enough to say who I think is going to be the best of the new wave.
Yeah, mostly what I'm thinking about is, you know, I honestly find that the best figures in the game tend to be the secondaries.
Yeah.
At least with, you know, Django and like the utility that they offer is in some ways bigger than the primaries. So
The next thing that I want to talk about, so Vader 2's box. He is coming with stormtroopers. And I know we've already seen the stormtrooper captain. And I think we did we see the stormtroopers unit card or character unit
we
card
did before? Not.
Okay. Nope. So that was all spoiled. We also got the stormtrooper sergeant's stance card. What I want to do is just talk really quickly about these stormtroopers because we think especially Sam thinks that they're going to be strong. I think everyone thinks they're going to be strong. But Sam, what is it about these guys that you think is going to make them as awesome as you think they're going to be?
So they combine some things I love about support. So the best thing about Fifth Brother to me is, well, there's a couple, he has a lot of things going on. But he is a sticky figure with a high amount of health that has auto displacement.
Yes.
And these guys have a high amount of health, and they have auto displacement, and they have two bodies, which is Fifth Brother's big weakness.
Yeah.
It just has one body. And I think that that itself is just going to make them staple supports, that you're going to see them in a lot of different places, and that they're going to be able to pull their weight in a bunch of different situations. Just because they have this ability, it costs an action and a force, that's a heavy cost, just to automatically move people off. And also they're able to split the board with that two body pressure that can give out, kind of like a combination of like Magna Guards and Fifth Brother a little bit.
Yes.
So I think they're going to be quite good.
Yeah, I think that it's super interesting because like Sam said, this For the Empire ability is a pretty strong tax, but they're 9 health. They are 4 cost, but man, these guys seem pretty scary. What's really interesting is that, so the assault tactics is allows them to dash, then they can suffer 1 damage to perform a focus action. So that's only 1 damage for both of them to focus. And For the Empire is guaranteed displacement. Then what happens is you become exposed. One is that the stormtroopers have sharpshooter, which is awesome, because that means they're these 5 dice, which seems super bad, is actually 7 dice. But what's also super interesting is looking at their combat tree, it's not high damage, but you have, it's so flexible. You have the ability, they don't have a pin, but they have the ability to heal. They have the ability to put on strain. They can push. They're just a really, really interesting figure.
They do have a pin in their expertise.
Oh, that's right. What am I saying? Of course they do. And on the first step, which is wild.
Yeah, they're an interesting unit. I think they're going to be pretty good. I would These are another unit I could see just being everywhere.
Yeah.
So
I think Stormtroopers will be a solid support. I see them as being not, I mean, they're definitely not Magna Guards. And I don't think they will be as good as I think Fifth Brother is, but I think in terms of like something like Clan Kree's or the Mando okay. Supes, I think they'll be in that similar area. I mean, they max out at 6 damage, which for a support is actually quite good. Their expertise is solid if we're talking about ranged. I think the heals, the double heal on step 2 is going to be interesting. I think the reason that I am lower on them is just because their first push is on step 3.
That is a great point.
And honestly, pushes are arguably the most important symbol on like even more so than damage. If you took Magna Guards and you put their first push on step 3, think about how far they drop.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
The question is does For the Empire compensate for that?
Right. And
yeah, because they still have the guaranteed displacement.
Yeah, I mean it's really solid, but it costs a force.
And an action, and you already have to be engaged, right? So there's kind of a lot of triggers that are happening there, which I think that Stormtroopers, I've got to give it to AMG. I think this wave of figures, it is different in ways I never anticipated in terms of what these guys were going to look like. Not just Stormtroopers, but what Boosh does. We're going to talk about General Leia in a second. Just all these figures are super, super cool. And so I think these guys are very interesting, and I'm super interested to see where they settle in terms of the meta.
100%.
Okay, so now what I want to do is I want to talk about Leia. Leia Organa Freedom Fighter. Okay, so Leia is... Sorry.
It's Organa.
I'm from Hoytsville.
That's a princess.
I'm from Hoytsville, guys.
You're like Billy Dee Williams. Fair. It's Han, not Han.
It's Han. Han. Han Solo. Well, gotta give Han more time. Okay, so here's the thing. I am more excited for Luke to come out just because I'm a super big Luke fanboy. But I think that Leia is such a cool figure in terms of what she's bringing. She just seems... She's got 10 health. Let me just quickly go through her card. So... Actually, before I do, I just want to say, I think my only problem with Leia Organa Freedom Fighter, besides the fact that her sculpt does not look that
it's
great
so ugly.
From what we have seen.
It's bad.
I'm going to take a knife to that thing because it's ugly.
Yeah, it's not great. And so, you know, I am sure there will be a community response. But my bigger thing is that I don't want to run Ewoks. That is just not my style. And she seems like she is the queen of the Ewoks. And so...
Yeah,
that's the only thing. But let's just quickly go over her card. So first off, her ability is start of activation is infiltrate at the start of this unit or this unit's activation. One Rebel Alliance character may advance. So that's obviously very strong. It's kind of reminiscent of Padme. Defensive maneuver, which is just like the clones' defensive maneuver, dash and gain a hunker. Super awesome. Explosive charge. This might be this is her most interesting ability. It's two force. You choose an objective within 3. Each allied character within 2 of that objective may dash and gain a hunker. Then each unit within 2 of that objective suffers 2 damage and removes any hunker it has. So that's awesome. Like, that's just a very, you know, she's tossing in a bomb. Very, very cool ability. She's got coordinated fire exposed, which we know is super good. And then she has this unexpected allies ability, which I think is super meh. But what it is it just gives Rebel Alliance and Ewoks effectively armor. Can cross synergize is the idea. She has 2 stealth or 2 stance cards, frontal assault, which is better for range, and stealth mission, which is better for melee. And I mean, that's she's doing great damage. She has the ability on frontal assault to get her one of her actions either defensive maneuver or explosive charge, but it's on the 4th step. And her expertise, while good, is not amazing. She has it's not amazing. I guess is just the only way to say so. I don't know that she's going to be really doing a ton of damage with that ability, but or she's at least not going to be getting it for free, but she just seems a very cool figure and she's got great defensive expertise. Great defensive.
Yeah. Really solid defensive. I think she's going to be super solid. I think, you know, if we compare expertise to Vader and Dooku, you know, people who are getting two crits for one expertise. But like,
yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, right, under frontal assault, one to two gets her a crit and a damage, which is fine. Yep. Like that's not.
Yep.
That's fine. And then yep. if we think about, like upwards, she gets a reposition on
yes.
expertise. Which is there even another figure that gets a reposition on expertise in the game?
I don't know about offensive.
I don't think so.
Yeah, which is...
I mean, magnet. Lots of figures have it on their tree, but...
Yeah
but I don't know, Scott. That's a good point.
Right, so if I'm chucking dice and I get three and I get to reposition off of that, then... I mean, if I'm rolling seven dice, what are the odds that three of them are going to be expertise?
Yeah. I mean, you're... at not half, but you're going to roll one to two, right? Which can spike up to three.
Yeah, and also depending on, like, if you... say focus or you have something to give you extra point. Dice. There's just, it's going to be interesting. I think she's going to be a really solid choice. I think she will live and die based off of how good Ewoks are.
That's a great point. That's a very good point. What do you think, Sam?
I think explosive charge is going to be a really interesting ability. It seems to be like something you want to do maybe on objectives that were active last struggle but are no longer active this struggle, because that gives your team extra movement and your opponent's now punished for their guys who were just hanging out doing nothing.
Yep.
I think that unexpected allies, I'm going to guess that that's going to be impactful in some interesting ways. Like, you throw the Golden God C-3PO secondary in there with this Leia and a bunch of rebels and or Ewoks, and then those guys can never be shot at ever.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Essentially what that ability does. So I think it's going to build some really interesting lists. I think unless there's some force refresh, these are going to be force hungry lists that are not going to be able to use all their abilities, because 7.3 force is not good, and she is force hungry.
Yeah, that is a great point. She has 7 cost, but only brings 3 force. And so Luke and Vader 2 are the same way, but they have innate force refresh. The other thing that's kind of sad is that Leia does not have access to push pin. You are either pushing or you are pinning. And that, I mean, I never loved that. And so, you know, you don't need it. You don't need push pin, but where you're not doing a ton of damage and you're not having a ton, like she doesn't have a ton of shoves, I guess, on stealth mission. She's okay. But anyway, that's the only thing that I think is a little worrisome. So,
yeah, I think that the metric that I always am using is how far from the start is your first shove? And I think if it's on your second step, then I think it's all right. But if it's on your third step, I think it, generally speaking, you're always going to get two steps if you have a solid attacking character, unless you're not, you know, shooting into a super defensive character like Dooku.
Yeah.
So I think the fact that frontal assault is on the third step is a little worrisome, especially considering, you know, she only has as the one. I mean, the fact that she has a crit on the first one is better. That helps. But yeah, I'm going to flip over for access to those shoves.
Yeah. I think that's right.
I think she's going to oddly want to be in melee a lot because of that.
Yeah.
Like, stealth mission is a better melee side, has better shoves, better melee expertise. And Leia's just going to be brawling up in the fray, which is going to be not what I expected from a Leia character, but that's not something that she's really afraid of either.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the idea is that because of defensive maneuver and what I think... in terms of a range defense, I think she's going to be a figure that your opponent really is going to want to close on anyway, because she's got defensive maneuver. So she's got hunker, and she doesn't have a way to retain them unless you're going to be running her with Obi-Wan or something. And so with that being the case, I think your opponent is naturally incentivized to want to close anyway. I think she's a very interesting figure. We're not going to do it this episode, but what we're going to do is JK is super excited to run Ewoks. So in the future, we're going to have an Ewok episode. We're going to talk about building around them once we've had the chance to either get a little bit more information or even get some games in. But anyway, I think Leia's going to be awesome. I'm really interested to see how she turns out. I'm super interested to see when they spoil Han. But okay, let's get to the main topic. What we're going to do is we are going to discuss tournament organizing. We have done this a lot. So talking about building up communities, as we are getting ready to head to LVO, Adepticon is going to have some awesome Shatterpoint stuff. It looks like the OP scene is starting to pick up steam. We want to talk about what you can do locally in order to have good tournaments, well-supported tournaments, or the tournament support that is appropriate for the level of commitment of you and your community, right, is the thing to be talking about this way. Again, we are old hats at this. We ran tournaments, many, many tournaments for IA. I've done things with X-Wing. Scott's done stuff with MCP, Samsung stuff in all those communities. We know what we're talking about in terms of what do we need to do logistically? What do we need to do in terms of prize support? So we're kind of just going to have this conversation and talk about what we think would be most helpful to you. So first off, the big thing I think to think about, the most important thing when we're talking about tournament organization is just talking about logistics. So the big things you got to figure out here is where you're going to have the tournament, when are you going to have the tournament, and what kind of a tournament are you going to have? So in Utah, we have a store in Salt Lake called Demo that we like to go to, centrally located. They've got great table space for playing games, good store. Okay, so it's been naturally easy for us to plan events around that. But when we were playing IA, we were playing at Blackfire Games in Utah County. We were playing at multiple places in Davis County and in Weber County. The community was large enough when we were playing IA that could kind of work. It doesn't seem like that's really where we are with Shatterpoint at least at this point. Scott, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would say that if I was going to host a tournament and I expected decent turnout from everyone in the community, like I guess I would put like if on a good day, I could expect to get 8 players.
Yeah. Without having to break the bank, we can get 8 players. We've had, when we have run at tournaments at Demo in the past, we've had, I think, 14 and 12. And so we've had really good turnout, but that was with a lot of planning, a lot of organization. And I think the reason why location matters and thinking about location matters is that I think that you should, as much as you can, try to concentrate your community, at least while it's growing, so that there is a place that everyone knows that you are going to, or that it's not like, oh, which one of the 12 stores are we going to be having OP at? So get your location planned. And then when we're talking about length, number of rounds, this is 100%, I think, a function of how many people that you're going to be having there. If you're going to have 4 people there, you can do 2 rounds, you can do 3 rounds, and that's all you need, right? If you do 3 rounds, you literally all play each other. If you're going to have more, I have never played in a Shatterpoint cut event. We haven't had enough. We haven't had enough people. I think you need to probably be around 16 people in order to do that. And that also makes it so that if you have a cut, that's adding 4 hours effectively to your event for players who make the cut. So when we were doing IA games would take about an hour, a little over an hour, but with setup and everything like that, in terms of you're looking at about 90 minutes per round, was at least that's my recollection of how we do it. So if we were going to have a regional or something like that, we would have most of the time 5 rounds and then cut, Swiss cut, go to top 4 or whatever and have 2 more rounds. And that worked totally great. I don't think the Shatterpoint community is quite there, at least for most of our local events. So I think what you want to do is you want to figure out your location, assume that you're probably going to be doing a 3 or 4 round event, and then you just got to start drumming up numbers.
I think you're accurate. I don't think there's anything you've said that's inaccurate there. In terms of... I think the important thing to think about when you talk about a tournament is when we talk about logistics is there's sort of a breaking point where we talk about how far is someone willing to travel?
Yes.
For the type of event, and then how much are they willing to pay to be at the event? Because you know, there's a significant difference between I'm going to play a game for free versus I'm paying $5, I'm paying $10, I'm paying $15. And I think sometimes we underestimate the fact that, like, these things cost money.
Yeah.
And not everybody necessarily has the funds to be able to play these games. Exactly. Yeah. And, like, you know, for me, I am cognizant of that because oftentimes I'm just sort of like, it's $5. And other people are like, hey, like I actually like really budget my money just to be able to play this game. And so it's something to be cognizant of and something to be aware of. But
yeah, it's also the case, this kind of feeds into a discussion about price support, but cost is a big deal, right? In terms of people's discretionary income, what they're going to be spending money on. If you want to go all out with price support and do something awesome, that's probably going to mean you're at a $20 entry fee. Now, I think that totally works if you're doing something like a regional event or a well-attended store championship event. If you're having like a small or, you know, an event where you're just looking to get bodies out, I think Scott's right. I think that really what you should be thinking about is that tournament, that entry fee is going to compensate the store for you being there. And you should not think about, at least initially, that's probably not going to be something subsidizing price support, right? You want people to feel it to be accessible, and it's not going to be accessible if, you know, they're having to spend $10, $15 or play three rounds of casual Shatterpoint, right? I think is the way to think about that. Sam, what do you think?
Yeah, with that, like I've, you know, different periods in my life, I've had to be more cognizant of budgeting for tournaments and such. And it's been a real thing, especially you have to factor in travel costs. And it's like, I only have so much for, you know, tournaments. And we want to get as many people there as we can. And I think just taking a look at your community, deciding what type of event is this going to be? Like, is this just, I want to get community involvement. So we're going to host a small tourney. We're going to have not a ton of like prizes, but keep the entry as low as possible. I think those can be great. I think when you have those bigger tournaments, these regionals and such, that's when I think that the cost can be justified to go up. I think a lot of those, as the community is built, I expect to see like a qualifier system or such, like with the MCP at LVO, they only have so many spots for their big tournament. And to get spots in LVO, they have kind of like regional tournaments everywhere where you win spots to that event. I expect to see things like that pop up. And with those, you're going to have people coming from further away, and you're going to, and the costs are going to be different for that as well.
Yeah. One thing is, Sam, so Sam, you worked at a store in Logan for a hot minute. It wasn't a very large store, so you couldn't host like a Shatterpoint regional or an X-Wing regional or anything like that. But what was the store's, I'll just say, rubric for deciding whether or not to allow, you know, a community like Shatterpoint to host an event? What would you do? Was it kind of like a first come, first serve? If you're not doing magic or something, you'll let it happen. What did you expect in terms of getting a cut of the entry fee or getting all the entry fee? How did it work at the store?
So generally, if there was an entry fee, the store wanted to be giving something out.
Yeah.
Like if customers came and paid money to the store, the store itself would supply something for the tournament. You know, there's always something we would add, whether it's a kit that we purchased from, you know, from AMG or prize support for Magic the Gathering packs or whatever. Just the general, if it was a paid event, the store provided something in terms of prize support.
Well, and we should,
as far as that was our store.
If you have a kit, that means cost is required. Stores will charge you to host a tournament, and so you collect a fee as part of that. Versus oftentimes, if you're just sort of willy-nilly on your own doing a game, then you don't have to charge anything. You can just opt to not pay anything.
Yeah, that's exactly true, right? So like if you don't have like a kit or something, the store would let you host events. The biggest thing was just scheduling early enough that we could guarantee you the space, right? Yeah. If you're coming up to a store the week before or 2 weeks before, it's not likely that you're going to have the table space to host these larger events. But as long as you're contacting your stores early enough, General guideline, like minimum, like a month for these events. There, you should be able to get space and host an event. And if you don't want prize support, stores are happy often to just let you come in for free of charge and play your event.
Which is kind of wild when you think about it. That surprises me because it is space in the store that you're not then going to be allowed to use for other things, right? I mean, I guess that you're getting bodies in the store who can then, those people can then buy things. But still, like, yeah, that's really generous on a store's part. I think if I were encouraging people, you know, in terms of reaching out to stores, I would want, I think you should assume that the entry fee goes to the store and at the very least help them cover the cost of space. Because not all stores are going to be like Sam's, right? In terms of just, hey, you know, if you get here early enough, we're totally cool with that. But that's just my thinking on it.
Yeah, I think stores also just having bodies there to play the game, it gets other people interested, gets eyes. And from my experience, if there's a tournament for a game, that usually means that we sell product for that game.
Great point.
So,
which is true. And a great point. Okay. Well, with that being the case, so if you've got a store, obviously the idea here is that what you want, it's awesome if you have buy-in from the store in terms of saying, hey, we want you to host this community. Like, we want to host an event. What can we do in order to help you host an event? Let's assume you don't have that. Let's assume that you are just looking for a store in order to host an event. You want to pick one that I think is probably going to work for the largest number of your devoted players. Okay. So if it's all in Utah, we have a pretty strong group in Davis and Weber County of players playing. So us going to demo only really makes sense, which it does most of the time, if we're going to be able to get other players from south of where we are, right?
Yeah.
And so otherwise, we should just be playing at a store in Davis or Weber County. But that's something that you've just got to figure out with your community. The other thing to think about is, how often should you be having tournaments? And should they be casual or competitive? And I think these kind of run together. I think Scott suggested that we have events every quarter, or maybe JK suggested that.
No, I suggested that.
Which I think is a great idea, right? I want to do things a little more frequently just because I think we have the bandwidth for that. But right now, with the game in its infancy, and honestly, it does not seem like the Shatterpoint OP is not taking off. It's not doing what I remember happening with X-Wing, where X-Wing is released and pretty quickly it develops this very robust OP scene. That doesn't seem to be happening with Shatterpoint. And so if it's me counseling in terms of what people should be doing, I think you want to be having events frequently in terms of consistently. So Scott says once a quarter, I think that's a great idea. I think once a month is a lot, but if you've got up in British Columbia, up in Canada, in BC, they have got frequent events that are being attended by 12 to 20 people every time. That's awesome. If you've got it, do it. Because having more frequent events means that you are going to be able to, that is what builds communities. If there is constantly kind of this churn of people being able to show up for stuff. And then casual competitive, I think that generally you should think about your tournaments being casual, more casual. They're competitive in that, you know, we're here to win and everything like that, but it's casual because you're not hosting a regional, you're not hosting a store championship, and you want people to feel welcome. We want to include people. We want to bring people in, and having sweaty tryhards is good for the game in the sense of it allows exploration of game growth. But I think it's really bad for the game in terms of if new players are showing up, they're showing up to a tournament and they're not feeling like they can just play, then something needs to change. And I'm just going to give a quick anecdotal example. So for me, I don't play Armada really, but I have a bunch of Armada stuff. There are people in our local Utah scene, who do a really good job of telling me, Kenny, who plays Armada literally once a year, maybe twice every 3 years. I just do not play it that frequently, but saying, hey, Kenny, you can show up to this event. Yeah, you're not going to win. In fact, you're just going to get crushed, but it will be, everyone is super friendly. Everyone is very casual in terms of helping you with triggers, helping you understand kind of what's going on. I am totally willing to show up when there is a casual event and I know that my opponents are going to be friendly and I can play this, you know, Star Wars capital ship game. That's what you should be aiming for. You should make it as easy as possible for newer people to join?
Yeah, so I think it is important to have events for people who want to grind and play at a high level.
Okay.
I think that not all your tournaments should be like that. Most of them should be more casual, but I think it is important. I think that is a reason why people play games, that there's a certain percentage of every game crowd that that is what they want to do.
Yeah.
And I think that it's good for the scene to have things like that. For example, I think it would be awesome if some of these big conventions do have tie-in tournaments that local scenes can do. So like maybe once or twice a year you have a bigger tournament that gets you invite to another tournament.
That would be right? So awesome. Yeah.
Right. So like LVO, eventually I assume this game will go to a space where there's not going to be enough spaces for everyone who wants to go to LVO. So you turn LVO into an invitational where you have like, you know, every population that has a scene gets an invitational, the top two spots have an invitational qualifier, top two spots get an invite. And then like an MCP, you can go to LVO and try their last chance qualifier tournament for everyone else who wants to play in the main event.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that would be awesome. And so you have like one of those a year for your local big tournament. And then all your other tournaments are these more casual tournaments. I think it's good to have a healthy mix like that. You want your casual tournaments so you can get everybody in. And you want one or two events that people who want to be competitive can really dive into that part of the game. Not that they're going to be necessarily less friendly, but just there's a different expectation in terms of how much you should know about the game heading into these things.
Yeah.
I guess I'm just saying that not every tournament needs to be focused on the new player, but most should be. Like,
yeah,
we should be accessible enough.
Yeah, I think that's... What do you think, Scott?
So I'm going to take a little different tact. I think that there is a general, I think that the, what you guys are talking, what you're talking about is a very popular term that I think is missing something important, which is that the whole point of a tournament is competitive. What you guys are talking about is a league.
Yeah.
Not a tournament because look, there is something to be said for, we want to create an environment where everyone is friendly, but that does not mean not competitive. Where everyone is kind, where everyone is nice to each other. Yeah. And that's about enforcing rules. But if you're going to host a tournament where there is prize support, then I think that you can't say, well, this is going to be catered to a casual player because by nature of the event, it is not casual.
Yeah.
And so for me, if I want to, if I want to have like a, hey, let's just get together and play games super casually. And like, we can take back turns and we can, because oftentimes that's what we're talking about, right? Where, hey, you made an obviously dumb decision, but it's only obviously dumb if you've played the game for 6 months and this is your first game. Let's take that back. It doesn't matter that we rolled dice. Let's just, you know, and we do that because we want people to have a good experience and they don't want to, we don't want them to feel, we want them to want to come back, right? We don't do that in tournaments and we shouldn't. And I think that if your first game ever is at a tournament, I think there is a certain amount of grace, but there is no expectation that we're going to cater to the fact that you are new.
This is interesting because I'm coming from a position of doing a lot of Magic the Gathering tournaments, and there is definitely different types of tournaments that some are more casual.
Interesting.
Like we have, so there'll be like paid, like you'll have your five, like for example, we had standard tournaments every week that were $5 entry that had prize support every time. But those were casual events. Like, people, it was typical that there would be like, hey, I made a small error here, mistake. People were like, oh yeah, let's rewind and fix it. That was just the expectation at these casual events, even though they were small buy-ins with prize support. It was, so I've definitely seen tournaments, like actual tournaments with prize support on the line, you're like just trying to win, that have been more forgiving. And it just, that's been my experience with like the Magic the Gathering scene and seeing these different there's like different levels of tournaments. Like this is your, that you, when you input it on their software, there's like, this is input as casual. And then there's different levels that would go up for like how strict the rules enforcement is by your judge on hand based upon the different event.
But so I want to point out though, that you can, what two players do at the table is ultimately irrelevant in terms of like from a tournament perspective. So if you're in a super hyper competitive tournament and the player concedes that it's okay for them to go back and change something, that's fine. It's not like you should be like, no, you can't do that. You have to hold them to it. Like, what to put? It's a, you hold people to the rules when there's a disagreement, not when there's agreement. And I guess my point is simply that you don't say to other people, like, I guess my idea, because what I'm expecting, and I've seen this happen, is if I'm hosting a tournament, I don't put a rule of like, oh, and we're banning the best cards. Unless that's unless there's like a conceit of like, hey, we're doing this specifically because it's like the worst stuff event, like it's a event specifically about the worst stuff, then you know, that's fine. But like, I think as a tournament organizer, you set expectations about behavior, but in terms of like what people are coming there, because we want to cater to casual people, but let's be honest, if you want to build a community, competitive people who want to show up and play a lot are actually the kind of the bread and butter that we kind of ignore. Like,
I don't know that.
Well, but Kenny, I want you to think about this. Would you consider me and you competitive players? People who are competitive?
Yeah, absolutely.
Who do we play with more often than anyone else?
The competitive players.
Yeah, absolutely. Each other, right? Yeah. And the casual person who's going to show up once every 2 months, that's great, and we want them to show up, but they're not necessarily how you build a consistent group of people showing up. Like, if you're building a big community with casual people, it's, well, I've got 50 casual people, and we hope that 4 of them show up a week, so we have, like, and it's a rotating group, right? Every week, it's a different 4, but we just have so many that it doesn't matter. It's not, it's not you're getting 50 people every week. The definition of casual.
Yeah, what do you think, Sam?
I agree with that from the perspective of as the store trying to build scenes, you need a core group of players who are, by and large, very competitive. Yeah. They're not necessarily, I mean, most of the time, and you want them to be very friendly too. Friendly, competitive players are the players that build your scene for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the, there's like a, you know, those like sort of 4-person diagrams where like on this side of the spectrum it's friendly and on this side it's competitive. And you want people who are friendly and competitive. And the worst thing is if they are not competitive and unfriendly. Unfriendly casual. Like, well, if they're friendly but they're not very competitive, I'll forgive them. If they're competitive and not very friendly, I won't forgive them. But if they're neither, I really won't forgive them.
Yeah, I think my thing is that if a person is listening to this podcast, they are likely to be at least more serious about Shatterpoint than the average player. And I recognize that it is very, you need to have players who are dedicated in order to build up the community. Casual people, by I think almost definition, are not going to really be focused on building the community. My thing is, I have a very different attitude towards tournaments than Scott does, because my thing is that unless it's a regional or like a high level event, maybe I guess a store championship, I am like a maximal degree of not cordiality. That's the wrong word, because Scott is very cordial. Accommodating is the way to think about it. If I'm playing against a newer player or even not a newer player, I really want it to be important that people who are showing up are going to have a good experience and not just get, you know, stomped or have feel bad moments or anything like that. And so for me, like if you show up to a tournament and you say, oh, I actually meant to do this here, unless we're at a very competitive event, generally, if you're a newer player, I have no problem being like, yeah, go for it. Like, do it. Because I am really focused on this longer vision in terms of thinking, like, I want this person to keep showing up to events. And so I'm not saying, because Scott is a very cordial player. He's a very friendly player. He's also very competitive, and Scott's very good at games. And that comes out obviously naturally when he plays games. I'm not saying that's bad at all. And I think that it, as we've talked about this more, Scott's right, Sam's right. You need the more serious players to be showing up durably in order to kind of give that meat to your community. But you really want the way you need to make converts, and you make converts by having people come in, having this experience that is a positive experience that they enjoy, and getting them to come back. Right. And so that's more where I'm coming from.
Yeah. And I absolutely believe that we should, you know, as a player, I will individually say, yeah, take it back. I'm fine with that. And I think a lot of where I feel comfortable, more or less comfortable with that kind of thing, has mostly to do with whether money is on the line.
Oh, interesting.
Like, and when I say money, what I really mean is stuff like gift cards for the store, right? Like if there's actual prize support, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because if you are taking something away from someone this comes down to people, it's up to them and what their choice is. But if I say, hey, like, yeah, that's fine, we can redo that, and then that changes the outcome of the match, then you did cost someone something tangible, right? Like,
yeah,
if it's just a number, a bragging rights, then nobody cares. But if it's like, hey, this is about whether or not you made a cut and you got the super cool premium dice that the tournament has, or you won a monetary prize, you know, I mean, there's a reason that, you know, cheating and rules and competition gets super severe in Magic when you go to the tournaments that have money involved.
Yeah.
Yep. Right. And
yeah.
And there's also this idea of, I even think of this intangibly, like if you drove 2 or 3 hours to come play at a tournament and you really wanted to do well, and they're like, oh, he's new, just let him retake the turn again, and you got and you didn't make the cut because of that. I think we should absolutely be kind and prioritize making a friendly environment that everyone wants to play in. I just don't want us to throw the baby out with the bathwater where we compromise on what a tournament is. And I think it's important context that I didn't know that, you know, where Sam's referencing, hey, you know, we have tournaments that are very casual in Magic. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. But at the same time, I always want to make sure that we're keeping with the spirit of what we're doing.
Yeah, I think that is a great point. And before Sam jumps in, I just want to say, Scott, I think that is a really good example where it can be a feels bad man for the other opponent or the other player in a way that is community destructive. So for example, if we would drive to Las Vegas, and we're going for LVO, but we would go to Las Vegas for regionals, right? And that's wild. If you go to Las Vegas for regionals, you show up and your opponent's like, hey, you know, I made this critical error and says, hey, I meant to do this. Is it okay if I take it back? You're like, well, I mean, I guess in the sense of you can do that thing, you know, it is the United States of America. You cannot do that thing in a way that I'm going to feel good about, right? You're breaking the rules. You're kind of taking advantage of this certain thing. And so that's a really good point. And that is something you should be cognizant of in terms of prize support and how you're calibrating on that. Sam, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that these are important things to bring up in regards to every tournament. And I think it's important to have like ways to distinguish what type of tournament you're at.
Yeah.
Like if you're a scene that has like weekly, like maybe you have a large enough scene that you have a weekly $5 buy-in tournament where the winner gets a $15 store gift card. And it's like, that seems significant, but it's also a weekly thing. Maybe that's pretty casual that it's like, hey, I'm paying my $5 just to come play because it's a weekly thing, different expectations. Now, maybe for some people, that same tournament isn't a weekly thing. It's a thing that happens once every 3 months and they drive an hour for it. That needs to be a different expectation, a different, like, it's the same prize structure, but there's a different expectation for what's going on at that tournament. And I just think that these things need to be clear. As the organizer, you need to be clear about what type of tournament it is to the people coming. So the people driving an hour away know, like from an hour away, know whether it's worth their time.
Yeah. I think that is an excellent point, and I completely agree. One thing that I talked about this a little bit with the Christmas episode, but prize support has been referenced a lot here, and I think that prize support is in a lot of ways going to set the tone as to what you should expect in terms of a casual. And it's also, in my opinion, where you as the organizer will spend the most time. So the ideas of things that you can do for tournaments is you can do alt arts, which are, I think, the easiest to do, although you do need to design them. Custom tokens that you can either design or buy off of Etsy. There's lots of great vendors for that. Custom dice. This is kind of hard. We are obviously going up in terms of scale. Etsy has the ability. There are vendors on Etsy through whom you can get custom dice, which is awesome. Baron of Dice, I know, does custom orders, but they're very expensive. There is a member of the Slack who's actually reached out to me recently who is getting custom dice made. He lives on the East Coast and he's getting custom dice made. I don't want to say anything about it because I don't know exactly what the details are in terms of what his total cost or everything like that, or what he's been able to do, or where he's going to have this event. I know it's pricey though, but that's also extremely cool, right? And then Etsy's just a great resource. There's lots of other things. There's Shatterpoint organizers, plastic organizers, card holders, things like that. So this is all stuff that you as the organizer can do at varying degrees of cost. You don't even need, and to be honest, if this is me and I'm thinking, I want to have prize support, but I don't want to do anything custom or anything like that, just go on Etsy. They've got great stuff, easy stuff that you can use the tournament entry fee in order to maybe cover a portion of the cost. That would be my recommendation for. You're looking for something easy, go on Etsy. There's tons of stuff. It won't be custom or unique because people can just buy the stuff on Etsy, but it'll show your commitment, right? Which might be the thing in order to get more players out. With IA, we had great prize support almost the entire way through the game. Custom dice were obviously a huge draw for players. Even alt arts are really good. I mean, it would be the thing to get me. We were going to everything anyway. But it would be the thing that, especially things like custom dice, I would drive. We'd go to Vegas for something like that, right? Or we'd fly to Denver, you know? And so that's something where that is, you are going to have to look inside your soul and think about what can my community sustain? What can my time, what can my resources sustain? Because you're going to have to front a lot of these costs. But there, it's kind of the sky's the limit for what you want to do. What I would encourage you, I've thought about this. I had originally only wanted the alt arts to go to people who sign up for the Slack, the Dooku Obi-Wan alt art. And I think that is kind of still my rule. But if you're, you know, out in Santa Fe and you're like, hey, I would love to host this event. I don't have time to do anything. Can you send me 4 Obi-Wan Dooku alt arts? I'd be happy to do that. Whatever we need to do in order to kind of get the wheels rolling, I'd be happy to do that. So
we can tell them in order to win, they have to join to get the prize. They must join the Slack.
Yeah, join the Slack. Quit being a jerk. The thing is that I have heard a lot of incredible ideas. Like this one guy reached out to me talking about doing custom dice, and looking at these custom dice, they are incredible, phenomenal, incredible, like in terms of quality. But I think that people are so creative. And with the X-Wing scene, which is what I saw the most of in terms of custom swag, there was just tons of really cool stuff that was released. And it adds just this awesome texture to someone's list, what they're playing with when they've got these custom cards. And so I'd really love for 1,000 flowers to bloom and everyone to be doing things like that. But for me, I don't think that prize support, I'm much more wanting to just get games in. But for some people, prize support is kind of the thing. Sam, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think prize support is an awesome way to engage community. I think if you're running some of these more casual tournaments, it's okay to not load it to the winner. Like, if you're just like getting something really cheap, you can just, if you have a small event, you can give it out to everyone there or just kind of like give it out randomly. I think it's nice. I think you do want to have something for the winner if it's a tournament, just kind of like an acknowledgement of, hey, you won. But, you know, it doesn't need to be heavily loaded to that. Like,
It's what distinguishes us. It's what distinguishes you as a tournament rather than just a casual play event.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. You want to have something that distinguishes the event.
I think that price support is incredibly important. Again, because it's part of what distinguishes something as sort of a tournament. I think that monetary price support, I couldn't care less about. Like getting a gift card to the store, I don't care. I think it's like, okay, I think that's nice for the store because oftentimes you're going to spend more than your gift card because you get a $15 gift card and these packs cost $40. So the store is going to make their money and then some.
Yeah.
And so, and also it's all, you know, it's not like the store is giving you the gift card for free. We already paid for it. So obviously the store has incentive there. For me, things like custom components are the real draw, things that you can't get anywhere else. And it also gives this, there's a part of a feels bad man of just sort of like, hey, I know you were really into these cool dice that they produced for this tournament, but if you didn't make the cut, you didn't get them, and that sucks. But it's also, it's kind of a status thing, and it's kind of, it gives stakes to a tournament.
Yes.
That I think make things very satisfying. It's a draw for people. So I think that you should also get creative with your price support. So obviously this is not free in a sense, but you know, I offer to paint things for tournaments because it doesn't cost anybody anything. It just, it's something I'm volunteering. And I think one thing that you should consider if you are a person of means and you're trying to build your community is being willing to front some of those costs.
Yeah.
For price support, for tournament organization, so that other people don't have to pay the cost because this hobby is already expensive. And some people who are trying to, you know, live in this hobby, it's just hard.
Yeah.
And so being cognizant of that can really help. But if you're organizing a tournament, I think generally speaking, your goal should be probably 8 players at least. You want to play 3 rounds. And you want to have something for the top player. I will say that one of the things that people often do is they will include something for the worst player, which I don't like. I've never liked it.
Really?
Like it.
Let me throw out why I don't like it. I think it's condescending. And I think it kind of just highlights like, hey guys, we know that everyone else played well. Here's the person who sucked the most. We're going to give them a pity prize.
Oh my God.
People like to do that because they don't want people to feel bad because they came and went 0-4 at a tournament. Yeah. But I'm going to be honest with you. While I'm really sympathetic to that, I don't think that the pity prize makes them feel any better about that unless it's really, really good. And it's never really, really good.
Yeah. So let me, this episode's already run long, but I want to actually get this, talk about this with you guys. Because what I'm thinking is for the Zi-Fi Regional, or not Zi-Fi Regional, the Zi-Fi Invitational, which we're treating kind of like a regional, is that one of the things we're going to do is we're going to have these custom card holders. They're acrylics. They're beautiful. It's going to be really awesome. So what it is you can put your character card in this thing, and it's going to have spaces for tokens, custom tokens. We're also going to have custom damage tokens, etc. It's going to be awesome, and everyone should go. Okay, so my idea is to make 2 of those. One goes to the winner, and the other one is raffled to, raffled to any player who stayed through the remainder of the tournament, or a player who stayed through the duration of the tournament in, like, the bottom half of the cut. Would you guys think it's better just to do the raffle? Like, what do you think?
So, here's what I like. I like what the winner gets to be something distinct. Something that they can like put on their mantelpiece and say, I got this for winning the tournament.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I do think it's good to have other prizes for other people. I think if you have something that's raffled out, it's different from the winner's prize.
Okay. Yeah. I can dig that.
I will throw this out here as well. I think that there is a solution to this that it doesn't really apply to your problem here. But I think when we talk about people like, well, I don't want them to feel bad for like coming all the way here and they just ended up losing a bunch of games. Again, I'm very sympathetic to. Okay, well, the solution is just give everyone something.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. There are a lot of tournaments where just for competing, here's your alt art.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so we do that, and that solves the problem.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
And then again, I think Sam is 100% on point. Here's my special thing I got for winning the whole thing. And again, if you're a really big tournament, if you're doing 32 people and you are cutting, here's the top 8, here's the top 4. And again, that's, I'm thinking about like if you were a official thing, like, I mean, I loved with IA where here's your top 16 cut prize. Here's your top 8 cut prize. Here's your top 4. Here's your, and so it was a signifier of I succeeded and I got this far and I did this and that's really cool. And so I think if we emulate that on a smaller scale where we say, here's your top 2, like if you got top, we like, for example, Kenny, if you have 2 things to give out, give them to the top table and make one a little bit different than the other.
Yeah, I think that is a great point. I also want to make one plug because so Scott's suggestion about painting a figure that came in reference to John out in Louisville was talking about organizing a tournament and trying to get bodies out. And Scott said, hey, Scott does painting professionally. And Scott said, I'd be happy to do a prize or do a paint job for a player there. And John wanted to do it as a random raffle. I think for something like that, a random raffle is a great idea. And I think a custom paint job is a phenomenally cool idea. That would be something that would get me to go to a tournament, is the opportunity to get something like that.
So, story about Scott's custom paint jobs and tournaments. My very first IA tournament, I'd already played some games with you guys. My very first IA tournament, I won the raffle for Scott's mini and he got me a painted mall.
Oh,
and
that's awesome.
I still have my IA painted mall from that tournament and it was awesome. It was an event. I didn't win the event. I did well. I like ended with a winning record. I lost to one of you two and yes. That was my one loss of the day. And, but I remember that. It was a great event. I, you know, got my alt arts for, you know, and I won that raffle and it was awesome. And I still have that mini that comes out whenever I play IA campaign now and Maul shows up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that, again, I think it's a really good idea being creative and things like this, like Sam still got this stuff. I think that is a really cool thing about prize support is it can be the thing that oddly enough is the most durable in terms of these small little things that you don't think matter is the thing that people remember the most because they have them and they hold on to them. And so I'm not saying people should not feel the pressure that you can't have tournaments unless you're doing awesome swag, but you should know that the effort you invest in generating good swag will be something that people remember. Right. So
absolutely.
All right. Well, good luck, people. We would very much encourage people to do your part in terms of building community and hosting tournaments. If you have any questions, problems, things that you want to, you know, you want feedback on, you want to talk to people about it, we would love to do it on the Slack. I think that what I have noticed is really important is that for people who are looking to build the community, what you should be thinking about is who are other people who are close or regionally close who are also looking to build the community, and how can I support them and ask for support from them. So like, for example, if you live in the Midwest, I know that there are events that are going to be happening in Kansas City. I'm sure that something will be happening in Nebraska and Lincoln where Ben is. There's Adepticon, right? Like these are things that you might think, oh, I can't do this or I can't do that. That's totally fine. You can only do what you can, but you should remember that that's what other people are saying. So when you're like, well, no one's showing up to my stuff. It's like, well, people are busy, right? And why aren't you showing up to things, right? Is the thing to think about. So show up to stuff, do your best to be friendly, welcome new players. And if you have anything that you'd like to talk about or discuss, we'd love to do it. So we want to thank everybody for listening. Have an awesome night.